Dear Tightrope family, we are joining Patreon. We're partnering with Patreon because they are empowering creators to maintain independence.
To preserve our independence of mind, to preserve our free spirits, and most importantly, to preserve our quest for truth.
By joining, you will gain access to special opportunities to engage with us as we share what we're reading, offer behind-the-scenes clips from our episodes, and ask you for your input around what we should focus on next.
Please be with us on this journey.
Together, we can amplify truth, cultivate hope, and work to create a just world. Thank you, and stay strong.
And I point out to people, I say, I know you want the police gone. I know they're not doing the right thing, but we've got to do a better job of taking care of each other. Take that crime off the block, as Gil Sadhera used to say. So that is a challenge.
We are witnessing America as a failed social experiment.
How do we tell this story in a way that builds the kind of emotional momentum that colorblind ideology built?
So many young brothers and sisters of the younger generation find themselves so far removed from the best of their past.
What are we going to make out of the nothing we've been given? How do you envision possibility? Hey everyone, welcome and thanks for joining us on The Tightrope, where we engage in rich dialogue and try to keep our balance on any number of tough issues. I'm Tricia Rose, and I'm here with my dear friend and colleague, Dr. Cornel West. Hey Cornel, how are you doing today?
You're doing well. You're looking wonderful like always though, but it's always a blessing just to be alive, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I know. Although it is harder to be alive, it is a blessing. It is a blessing. Have you been pondering any issues right now that you want to share with our fantastic audience and friends and family? What's been on your mind at this moment?
You know, as we get deeper into this coronavirus crisis, it becomes very clear that the despair, the despondency, the wrestling, what feels like a certain kind of helplessness and impotence is pushed aside by solidarity and is pushed aside by memories of those who came before who were wrestling with similar things in their time. And I think in the last week or two, you could just feel this fork in the road becoming more and more crystallized, not just in terms of the national quest for the White House now with Sister Harris, our dear sister, being added to Joe Biden. And that's going to be a beautiful thing because, you know, look, Joe Biden, you got like Pat Boone in the Apollo trying to sing. And you're going to need somebody from the Black musical tradition coming in through Jamaica and
trying to help.
And so forth, but shaped by the Black church, Howard University, and all of its greatness, her stamp. And she's an AKA sister. We Alpha brothers have always been breakdancing around our AKA sisters because they've got so often the brilliance and the charisma as she does. Now, I'm critical, of course, of her politics, but her spirit, comes in such a way. And so you can just see the way in which spirit solidarity pushes back despair and despondency. So we have some sense of possibility. I think Brother Biden was right about that when he said possibility becomes crucial. It's just which particular possibilities toward poor and working people as opposed to toward Wall Street or Pentagon. What kind of possibility are we talking about here? But the issue of spirit and music and arts and love and family and friendship, those become so crucial. But how do you deal with the increasing despair and despondency?
Well, I mean, you just lifted me up with that thought, with that meditation. I guess I want to start with the thing that feels the hardest, which is feeling like you have to avoid other human beings all the time. When you're at home, you feel isolation. But the other day, you know, I very rarely go to the store and went out to one of these big box stores with those long aisles. And all I kept thinking was every time someone was about to pass me, like, were they too close? You know, and I was in this sort of psychic state of keep everybody away. Yeah. And I thought, man, this can't go on for long, you know, because I don't think it's a human being's core sort of sensibility to be in a perpetual state of stay away. And And so I started thinking about how hard that is for families, right? If you don't live with them, you can't constantly quarantine. A kind of emptiness, like a loneliness that's very hard to describe. You can't run into a friend and give them a hug. So, I mean, just those basics, I think, have been really difficult. But I have a fantastic partner. You know, Andre is an amazing husband.
Oh, and, don't come better than Andre.
Yeah, it doesn't really. It truly doesn't. So I'm profoundly blessed with that. So I don't take that for granted. But I think that ultimately this election, knowing that Kamala and Joe Biden have a chance, I mean, we don't know what's going to happen with the post office, but have a chance of just bringing this whole situation to an end, knowing that they're not going to be promising the moon. But I think they will allow for more space for those of us who want to live in a just and love-infused way, that there'll be more space for us to breathe, really. And that's the beginning of all that possibility, it seems to me. So ironically, the election, I mean, if this weren't an election year and we didn't have the possibility of maybe ending Corona and getting rid of Trump at the same time, ironically, the election might be something to look forward to as a way to have a victory in the midst of so much uncertainty and so much loss.
No, I think it's true. I mean, on the one hand, it's sad that the major alternative to such a low grade option, which is Trump and company, the neo-fascist gangster in the White House. But the major option is Biden. You know, you say to yourself, God have mercy. Is that the best option we as Americans, given all of these marvelous persons in the country, creative and courageous people in the country and fellow citizens, that's the best we can do? You see, that shows how decrepit our electoral political system is, that it can't allow the translation of the imagination of the American people in a broad way. And yet, he's certainly at this moment with Harris.
It does. Yeah, here's hoping.
The best alternative.
Yeah. I'm definitely looking forward to that debate between she and Mike Pence. That's going to be
highly. She gonna do him in. That's going to be something.
Yes, I might actually watch all the way from start to finish with some popcorn for that one.
I wish she could debate Trump.
I know that would be so nice. She might just have to do, you know, we'll let the Sandman take him off the Apollo stage. And then she'll just come in and just say, hold on, wait a minute. We got a replacement here.
Oh, no, that's true.
Yeah.
Very true.
You're so right that we have to stay close to not just loved ones, but to, you know, the spirit of what matters in the world in this moment. You know, COVID seems like it's taken so much away, but in that process of clearing the deck, it also allows you to really focus on the building blocks. When you have to rebuild, you're like, okay, what are the real key blocks? What do I really need? What did I think I used to need? And so there's a real opportunity there, right? To stay focused on the right thing. Well, we're just going to keep struggling along. And some people have written to me and said that, you know, you and I'm sure to a lesser extent myself, but the show is inspiring to them. It gives them hope at a time. Yeah, really is a blessing. So we're just going to keep trying, right?
Well, you see, when Biden and Harris played Curtis Mayfield's Move On Up, I said, oh, you're playing with fire there.
Yeah, do you know what you mean?
Do you really, really, really mean that up from slavery, up from Jim and Jane Crow, up from spiritual despair, up from self-hatred, up from self-violation, and the affirmation of a love and a justice and an embrace of all but a grounding on the chocolate side of the city? That's the genius of Curtis Mayfield. I'm going to play with his genius like that now, Biden and Harris. Y'all know that. He's setting some high standards.
I don't believe they're aware of it.
I said, uh-oh, now you're really over your head.
Way over your head, yeah. I think they're just trying to reach out to where they know people are, but they don't know what they're getting into. I know Joe don't know that. That's something Joe don't know.
Joe don't know that. But he might have some black folk around and some white folk.
Well, Kamala will send him. She'll be like, look, she'll help him out.
She come out of black church in Harvard University and her AKA sister.
She'll help him. She'll correct. She'll definitely make sure the tradition is clarified. We're continuing our effort here to really tackle these really complicated issues on the tightrope by having a really fantastic guest with us today, Dr. Errol G. Southers, who's a former FBI agent, professor of the practice in national and homeland security, director of the Safe Communities Institute, and director of homegrown violent extremism studies at USC. He's also an adjunct subject matter expert for the RAND Corporation. He was President Barack Obama's first nominee for TSA NSA assistant secretary and Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger's deputy director for critical infrastructure in California Homeland Security. He's done many, many things in law enforcement and police. He was a police officer in the Santa Monica Police Department and in the FBI. And he's just been across the board really engaged in thinking through not just law enforcement, but Homeland Security and the questions of terrorism. He's the author of a really interesting book called Homegrown Violent Extremism and a noted counterterrorism expert. Now, you know, he's also a Brown graduate, so I have to just give him a little Bruins shout out. Brown, you know, we try to do our thing in the wake of our bigger peers. And it's terrific to have Errol here with us because we're in such a crisis situation when it comes to communities, security, extremism, and so on. So Errol, thank you so much for joining us here on The Tightrope.
Thank you for having me. It's an honor to be with both of you.
Well, we're just delighted to have you here. I'm just going to start out with some background to see if we can learn a little bit about what motivated you. You know, I've always been curious about what drives people to join various aspects of law enforcement and certainly Black people, right? Because it's complicated, as you're going to say, I'm sure. But what motivated you to embark on this path and stay the course for so long in the way that you have? What motivated you?
Well, thank you. Again, I'm just one of those young brothers who had incredible parents who were both educators. And I had my scrapes with local police officers in New Jersey as a kid, although I never got in any trouble, never got arrested. But you know how it is when you're walking down the street. And finally, one day, my dad said, you know, you can't change the castle from outside the moat. And he said, you want to see change, be the change. So the rest is history. I was fortunate enough to get into the Santa Monica Police Department. I was drill instructor at the police academy, and I had a cadet who was there, and her husband was an agent, a brother who was a graduate of Berkeley Law School. And I met him, and he was the most impressive individual I'd ever seen in law enforcement in my life. And he and two other brothers in the LA division of the FBI took me under their wing, prepped me for what was going to be the written and the oral, and I maxed all of them and went on to the FBI. And again, how ironic that I go to an agency that just a decade or two before, if I had been in the FBI, I would have been Hoover's driver, and that would have been it. So I stayed the course. And over the course of now 40 years ago, when I started law enforcement, I ended my career at the LA Airport Police Department as assistant chief. I took it upon myself to really try to recruit people of color. I tried to recruit particularly women. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to be the change that I thought the profession needed.
What were some of those changes that you were focusing on that you felt was necessary beside sort of gender or racial integration? Were there sort of approaches to communities and policies that you felt needed some higher level intervention?
Well, one of the most important things that I thought that I always used to hear was just incredibly interesting was how they couldn't attract the right candidates from the communities these officers were serving in. And I'm running into bright young men and women who live in the neighborhood. And I said, why is that? And I used to always offer this analogy, especially to police departments. The FBI had no problem finding those people. Why can't the police department find those people? Mm-hmm. So one of the things we did at Santa Monica, we started a police activities league. I was a PAL kid when I was in New Jersey. And those kids came in the afternoon with after-school programs, tutoring, basketball, soccer. We had relationships with those young kids that weren't negative. They didn't see officers arresting people all the time. They didn't see people getting proned out in a felony stop on a car. So it was about developing those relationships. So my biggest concern was recruiting people from the neighborhood so that the department could reflect the demographic it was serving. That was my real goal, was to go out and get the right people.
Well, yeah, I mean, it was not only that they had good relationships, right, but that the police were not doing, it's not only what they saw, it's what they didn't see. But I just wanted to give some context for how you got involved. But do you think the police can actually be transformed into a fair, anti-racist safety presence in Black communities and poor communities? Do you think that's a possibility? I'm assuming there we largely agree that that's not what they mostly are.
We agree that certainly that's not what they mostly are. And I'll say a couple things. You're dealing with a culture. And so when you train people and dress people for war, they go into a neighborhood to do battle. And so it should not be a mystery to us when these officers do what they do. Second, you're dealing with a culture. I get so annoyed when I hear some person of color, male or female, that becomes the next hashtag, and the first response from law enforcement is, we need more training. They are epitomizing the definition of Einstein's theory of insanity. There is more training. When I was an assistant chief, my officers were in three categories every single day, either on duty, at training, or on vacation. Training usually was the dominant slice of the pie in terms of percentages of their time. They're trained constantly. And quite frankly, going to implicit bias training, going to de-escalation training for most of these officers is checking the box. They have no interest in it. They're not going to change. They're in a warrior culture when they need to be in a guardian culture. You know, they're not joining these departments to serve. They're joining many of these departments for excitement. And that's the wrong reason to be there. So to answer your question, there's going to be some, have to be some wholesale changes to happen to the culture for this to take place. And I think it starts with holding chiefs accountable. But more importantly, Professor Rose, chiefs are selected by councils and mayors. And oftentimes they select the person who takes the best interview instead of the best person to serve that community. And they all need to be held accountable.
No, I tell you, in typical fashion, Sister Trisha's already got this deep sea diving. These are some fundamental questions, though, brother. But first, I just want to say that it's just good to see you. And as my alpha brother, 1906, though, brother, we go all the way back.
You Thank know you, sir. I mean? We certainly do.
Martin Luther King Jr., W.B. Du Bois, Donny Hathaway, Duke Ellington, Charles Wesley. I mean, there's some countries that don't have the high quality of men that the one fraternity of black folk in America does in that fraternity. It's a blessing to see you because we've never really had a chance to meet before
right.
and spend time together. So it's a blessing. But let me raise this question. Now, Raj Baraka, the visionary mayor of Newark, has said that there's a sense in which police are very much like American citizens across the board. They just have state-sponsored guns. So there's a sense in which we can't really expect more of them in terms of how they come to terms with racism or sexism or whatever than we do with American citizens as a whole. Now, of course, we want to hold all of us accountable and hold them accountable, too. But the issue is this larger cultural and societal backdrop from whence our police come. What do you say to young brothers and sisters who would argue that maybe America just doesn't have the capacity to treat the masses of poor black people with decency and dignity? It's not just the police that don't do it, but it's other institutions as well. What kind of message, both in your example as well as in words, do you say to them who have that kind of fundamental question?
That's a very, very good question, obviously. And I offer this for all those institutions that reinforce and sustain the oppressive practices that we have to endure. I say for those progressive minds that are out there in those disciplines, become part of those institutions. When I talk about policing specifically, I say, you know, if I had a young progressive like you in uniform, we wouldn't have some of these things happening. If I had a young progressive like you in the banking industry, we wouldn't have to look at unfair lending practices. And so as diverse as we are in professions as a people, those young progressives that are coming up behind us now need to be part of these institutions to make a change. Again, I go back to my dad. We can't change these institutions from the outside. With all due respect to protest and unrest and civil disobedience, at the end of the day, the infrastructure has to change. And the only way that changes is if we become part of it and make it move.
Would you see substantive change in your years of being on the inside, as it were?
I have seen some changes. I mean, the most obvious change are the number of African-American chiefs I see across the country. I'm just delighted when I talk to them all the time. One of the most impressive, one of them is a very, very dear, like a big brother to me, is Jim Butts in Inglewood, who was chief at Santa Monica. And now he's building the most sophisticated athletic stadium in the world in Inglewood, SoFi Stadium, which is going to be home for the Rams and the Chargers. The other is a sister in Charlottesville, of all places, Rochelle Brackney, who's a PhD, and she is an absolute rock star. Talking about change, Dr. West, she has now put disqualifiers for hiring in her department in areas where you wouldn't have to think they have to be identified. But if you have been accused of, much less prosecuted for sexual assault, you can't be a police officer. That's almost a no-brainer, but she had to put that in writing. She's also gone one step further in my area. If you belong to an extremist organization, you can't be a police officer. And we have an incredible challenge with white supremacists, white nationalists, and extremists in law enforcement today and the military, more so than we've had a decade ago. In fact, I saw a quote from about 2 weeks ago where the FBI has suggested that this problem now in the military and law enforcement of extremists is 10 times worse than it was a decade ago.
And these are Ku Klux Klan, neo-Nazis, neo-fascists inside of the police department.
wearing uniforms today under the guise of protecting and serving.
Right, right. I know Germany's had the same problem with the neo-Nazis at the highest levels of the police. This is a global affair, but in the United States, specifically targeting Black people.
But to your point, when we become chiefs, we can make change.
If you got vision, courage, integrity, and so forth. You know what I
exactly,
mean?
Exactly.
Exactly. It's not really just a function of skin pigmentation. You got to have more than just beautiful Black skin in order to be a force for good.
You certainly do. But I will say this. I mean, I work very closely with Connie Rice, and Connie has revolutionized many departments across the country, most notably LAPD. And she's told me, she says, you know, Errol, sometimes it takes a consent decree for people to change. And that's what it took for LAPD to start to adopt change. It was a consent decree. But now, after 13 consent decrees in the Obama administration, here we are at the tail end of a four-year term. This administration has not undertaken one consent decree against the police department in this United States with everything that's happened. That's a huge problem.
Yeah, I hear you. Errol, I'm struggling with the notion that these chiefs who sound fantastic and potentially transformative, I'm just struggling with how much change we can expect someone in that position to produce when there's clearly almost a, like an invisible call, right? A kind of homing pigeon that is sending the worst of the society to the police forces to do the work they want to do, which is terrorize and harass and police. I mean, it's true they represent the police, do represent the spectrum of the U.S., right? But at the same time, one could say maybe they're a more consolidated group in certain political dispositions. And I'm just wondering, how can chiefs make such a difference once these people are already really saturating police forces? These are not one bad apple extremists. These are not one bad apple racists. These are cultures, as you say, that are embedded and imbued with this way of understanding that poor people, that Black people, that queer people, that drug addicts, that people who actually need our support the most are the people that they are protecting middle-class whites from, right? And that they're doing this kind of violence as part of their job. I mean, what can one chief do? That's like saying you're going to change the president of a university and all the faculty are going to get in line. I can tell you personally, that's not going to happen. So, you know, they can say presidents come and go, right? Faculty are forever. So how are you going to change this kind of culture with a chief, no matter how fantastic and brilliant they are?
That's a great question. And I'll tell you what you're speaking to, Professor Rose, you're really speaking to the power of police unions. So let me give you this. Minneapolis PD, which I'm very familiar with, I've worked with the Somali American community in Minneapolis for the last 6 years. It should have been a poster child for reform. When I was there originally 6 years ago, they had an indigenous, openly gay female police chief, and she left. During the Obama administration, DOJ went in and did a review of the department. One of the things that came out of that, which is you would never place a person handcuffed on the ground face down, as they did with George Floyd. Their current chief, when George Floyd was murdered, is an African-American. It doesn't get any better than that with regards to having a department that you would think would be in a position for change. And we all know what happened. Police unions and police officers are afforded more protections than the people that they arrest. And I can tell you, having been an assistant chief, it almost takes an act of Congress to fire a police officer. And when you do, about a third of them appeal and come back with retroactive back pay. So to your point, you're right. It's not just the chief. It takes a lot to happen. It is the reason change is so slow. And that's why, although I have been a proponent, as some others, of not totally defunding the police, I'm certainly understanding of how we could reallocate resources to make things different, to change that culture. You're right, there is a culture that is there. They feel protected, they feel empowered, and they continue to do what they do. And it takes more than just one person. So you're right on point.
Yeah. So why not do a little defunding? I've heard you say that when money's on the table, they're more likely to listen. I mean, wouldn't reducing their resources and cutting the ranks do some of the work that firing only to have them restored can't do?
I'm encouraged with regards to what's happening in San Francisco with their mayor, and I happen to know their chief, Bill Scott, who happens to be an African-American. They're now, as of 2 days ago, having teams go out to these nonviolent calls with counselors and other professionals that can more appropriately respond. You know, unfortunately, 911 is almost a reflex for some people. But quite frankly, a stranger with a firearm is not the best response to everything. You know, if a neighbor gets your car wet because your sprinkler system is on, that doesn't require a police officer, but that's who gets called. So they're trying this out to see if this can happen. We'll see. I will say this, after years and years of listening to we need more training, now when we start saying defund the police, we certainly do have the attention of these departments and the attention of these municipalities. And so I think you are going to see some changes. Mm-hmm. And I can speak for LAPD. They're doing the same thing with regards to teams that will roll out to these calls. And as you know, Professor Rose, in most municipalities, public safety and law enforcement is the majority of the budget. So there's money there. It can certainly be reallocated. And the other thing I think needs to happen are peer review assessments of departments. I would love to take a look at some departments to say, here are some things that you could do better, that need improvement, that you should strengthen, but that never happens. They never go into review. They're always left to fix themselves. And we have seen that doesn't happen.
Well, I mean, I don't know where that ever happens. The whole point of fixing yourself is to get some advice. What about community review boards? Why is that such a horrible thing to say to a police department? Why can't it be that the very people that you're policing have some say in their reception of services? I mean, this has been called for and requested for at least the 50 years that, you know, I've been paying attention to police force community relations issues. Why is that such an anathema to them?
Well, first, they don't want to lose control. And I'm smiling because I was director of a citizen police complaint commission in the city of Long Beach, California. And we had a representative from each of the 15 council districts, and we reviewed cases of misconduct. And it was very fairly done. And I'll be honest with you, quite frankly, the outcomes and adjudication of this civilian review board was often a little bit more lenient than internal affairs, but the officers pushed back against it because it's the citizens. One of the things that came out of the Obama administration, another item that's been disregarded by this administration, is a report by the 21st Century Policing Task Force that President Obama put together. Mm-hmm. There are six pillars in there. It's one of the most incredible documents perhaps in the last century as it relates to policing. It calls for exactly what you're recommending. There is no stigma or downside to citizen review. I don't mean a commission that rubber stamps what the department's doing. I mean a real review system that can change policy. So your point and your recommendation is right on target and really does need to happen across the board.
Professor Southern is just a wonderful professor and colleague and teacher. But this notion of what is crime, you think of Khalil Muhammad's great book, The Condemnation of Blackness. It's probably the best book written on race in 50 years in terms of the association of Black people with criminality. And almost to be Black in a white supremacist society is to be implicitly criminalized. So the people would look at you and I, for example, brother, as an uncivilized creature in a suit. So no matter how sophisticated we get or how many degrees we get and so forth, that long tradition of associating Black people with criminal potential or actuality, the issue of no matter how good our policing is, if the perceptions are still there, and then the added material and social and economic reality of poverty, decrepit schools, indecent housing, shattered families and communities, then do we have any chance of getting a hold of dealing with this crime and all of its different implications and all of its different forms? And then the last question, which is the Dostoevsky issue of just the dark corners of the soul, right? That there are human beings, or there's something inside of us that does have a propensity toward cruelty, sometimes gratuitous cruelty in terms of how we deal with life, knowing that death is coming and the insecurities of wanting to be superior. Black folk vis-a-vis Black folk. Black folk vis-a-vis brown folk. That's a human thing. So that how do we get a handle on these different dimensions of what crime actually is as someone inside of the system, as you've been able to do?
I think that first, your point about us being visually who we are and being a threat is very, very telling. I don't have to tell you how many times you'd been there. I get on an elevator, I walk down the street, and a person, if they only knew I'm the best person in the world, they should be walking next to.
Absolutely. Absolutely. The most reliable brother with integrity, but we still savages in the suit. You know, you say, right. Well, wait, what's going on here?
Exactly. The other thing I have to say is we've got a program in LA called CSP, it's Community Safety Program. And again, Connie Rice, where we actually required those officers to essentially almost live in that community for a 5-year period without leaving. And it has seen some very, very good results. We do have, like any other community, a serious crime problem. I'm disappointed to see the number of violent crime that's gone up since George Floyd was murdered. I'm going to date myself here, and Professor Rose, you'll appreciate this. I can't tell you how many times Gil Scott-Heron came to Brown when I was there. And I'm a big Gil Scott-Heron fan, and my favorite song is Message to the Messengers. Oh, and, you know, yeah. Sometimes we got to tell some of those young gun-toting brothers that they are actually facilitating what the Klan would do if they could come into our neighborhoods, and they've got to stop doing that. Yeah. I mean, that's just a fact. And I point out to people, I say, I know you want the police gone. I know they're not doing the right thing. But we've got to do a better job of taking care of each other. Take that crime off the block, as Gil Scott-Heron used to say. So that is a challenge. Unfortunately, we have people that are going to do bad things, no matter what color they are. And unfortunately, when those bad things happen, we're usually portrayed as the people who will do it. I mean, here we are now in an election cycle, listening to the fears of the urban housewife, with what's if we get to move into the neighborhood again, and those kinds of things. And I don't want to get off topic, but it's what's driving the work that I do is this fear factor, this fear of this white genocide that's underway. And so it's just being further perpetuated now at the highest level of our government on a daily basis, which makes it even more difficult. But I will say this, for those officers that have left the ranks, particularly I think it was in Buffalo after that incident happened where they pushed the older gentleman down, they left the ranks because they felt like they couldn't be cops anymore. We don't need them. They shouldn't have been there in the first place. We have to have a wholesale. What you're asking for in the way of changing the human behavior is how they see us. I don't even know if that's even possible. I'm the ultimate optimist when it comes to certain things. I don't know that if people have the human capacity to do that. You know, I look at George Floyd as not just an act of criminality on the part of that officer, but an act of plain inhumanity played out in real time.
And that's a spiritual and existential question.
Right. Do we have the capacities as
people? Do we even have, as human beings, not to engage in that kind of barbaric and calamitous activity?
Right, exactly.
And that's what I meant by the Dostoevskian terrain in terms of Raskolnikov and Crime and Punishment, right? That it was not just a matter of the more superficial things that people talk about in terms of crime. It really has something to do with also human beings who are just decrepit and seemingly bereft of being willing to cultivate the capacity to treat people decently.
Exactly. I mean, one of the things I tell my students every semester, no matter what they take away from my class, I want you to, most importantly, leave here and try to be a better human being. And I think that's really important.
Yeah. It's a really interesting tension here because the incapacity to be humane and decent is across the board, you know, not a racial issue, right? It's a human issue.
That's a human thing. That's right.
That said, we are leaving a certain communities open for the expression of that inhumanity, right? Mm-hmm. So that it goes unchecked and it goes unpunished and it goes uncriticized. So that societies and human societies produce cultural barriers and create buffer zones to protect us from our worst selves, right? To discourage us from behaving in ways that harm ourselves and others. But the real complexity here is about, as Cornell said a few minutes ago, what gets decided as crime, right? And what the police, for example, never do. I mean, one of the things that I've found really shocking about the extension of the capacity to use their own individual judgment, right, is to be able to literally, you know, the whole sets of policies around stop and frisk, mm-hmm. you know, involve no perception of a crime taking place, right, but increased discretion mm-hmm. to decide who to interrogate and do whatever else you want to. And this is only available in the context of the public, in the context of vulnerable communities. As I'm sure my colleague, Dr. West, would agree, it'd be nice to have them turn the pockets inside out of some Wall Street executives. You know? It would be nice for them to be able to stop and frisk
crime.
A couple of those brothers.
Absolutely. You know? And in fact, when you actually looked at U.S. foreign policy, let's say the 25,000 bombs that are dropped yearly, be it a Democrat or a Republican, in a context of war, okay, we understand. You're killing combatants. How many innocent folk are killed? Well, mm-hmm. it's hard to keep track because they don't want to tell the truth. I mean, we've got presidents that had killer lists every Tuesday that we're going to kill so-and-so, we're going to kill so-and-so. They kill American citizens with no trial at all.
Right.
You see, that's a crime.
Right, exactly. And 2 points, then they change uniforms and become police officers. That's one problem. But back to Professor Rose's point about discretionary decision-making, unfortunately, something that is severely overlooked in policing. 2 days ago, if you haven't seen it gone viral, two officers tried to put handcuffs on an 8-year-old that they were going to walk out of school to a police car, and he was so small, the cuffs fell off of his wrists. Who does that?
This is why, you know, the defunding and something like that has to be a part of what's going on, because first of all, there should be no police in school unless we're talking about a shooter, an active shooter. There's no reason to have police talking to 8-year-olds. If I had an 8-year-old and the police got called before I got called, there'd be some heck to pay. That's not going to make any sense. Let me ask before we run out of time, I want to make sure we talk about some of this homegrown violent extremism that your work has really focused on, because going back to some of what it kind of mirrors, or shall I say, follows from Cornell's point about the kind of international context where, you know, there's so much focus on terrorists coming from other places that we focus on being threatened by, when in fact, most of what we really ought to be threatened by is homegrown violent extremism. And I'm wondering if you could talk a bit about both what's actually happening, who are these violent extremists in our midst, what are their agendas, and why is it that we focus so much on so-called external terrorists when we have such a crisis here at home?
Great question, Professor Rose. Well, first, we always focus on external because the definition, as we have adopted it here in the United States by organizations like the Department of Justice and Department of Defense and the FBI, has always focused on the international threat. I'm smiling here because I had the honor, if you will, of testifying in the first and only trial they had as a result of the Boston Marathon bombings. And during that trial, although the Tsarnaev brothers, who had lived here for 10 years, and at least a sworn allegiance to ISIS, my point when I testified was, these guys are Americans. You may label them international terrorists, but they're Americans. And my point was, you're going to see more of this here. And I got taken to task by a congressman who decided that I was trying to suggest that we shouldn't focus on international terrorism. And I said, the data is what it is. And so one of the things that's been really interesting about this administration is their ignorance of data. In the last 10 years, we've had more domestic attacks here in this country by white supremacists and white nationalists than any other group. White nationalist groups last year increased for the second straight year, 55% since 2017. The FBI finally had to label that threat a national threat priority. They were in denial. And so those are the things that we're seeing. And I heard you in the opening talking about COVID. COVID has been the perfect environment for these extremist organizations to recruit and radicalize and share their message. They're doing it under the guise of pushing back against the government overreach to make you wear a mask, to make you stay at home. And so what you're seeing at these anti-COVID rallies are not so much people concerned with COVID, but people who are concerned with A, the government, and B, more importantly, this fear of a minority-majority country in 2045, and what they see is white genocide, and in their terms, the great replacement of their race here in America by people of color and immigrants. So it's been a really interesting breeding ground for them now to leverage COVID into the extremist ranks. And so as you look at some of the, I'm always amazed by what I saw in these anti-government stay-at-home rallies of these states that have open carry laws. And when you have nonviolent protesters who are unarmed and they wind up getting assaulted by the police departments that are out there. And you both know, with all due respect to California being proud of not having an open carry law, the only reason we don't have open carry is because of the Black Panther Party. In 1967, when the Mulford Act passed, because the Black Panthers realized they could stand at traffic stops with rifles and shotguns and watch, they were going to police the police, and Governor Reagan and Assemblyman Mulford, backed by the NRA, went to the state and said, we can't have any of that. And the guns went away. So what you're seeing now, Professor Rose, assisted and enhanced by the capacity of social media and the internet, is extending the reach of these racist ideologies across the board And until about a year or two, I had to go toe-to-toe with the FBI 2 years ago when they tried to promote something called Black Identity Extremism.
Yeah, that was my next question, yeah.
Telling them how much of a farce that was. And I happened to be testifying at the Congressional Black Caucus along with another former FBI agent. And finally, Director Wray removed it last year after disseminating that information about BIE to 11,000 police departments across the country saying, you need to look out for these activists because they're the people killing cops. Another data point, over 80% of the officers killed by extremists in America have been killed by white supremacists. So there's no data to support what they're pushing here with regards to the international threat or the homegrown threat being perpetuated by anybody other than white nationalists.
I'm dumbfounded by the level of danger they're willing to put themselves in order to advance the ultimate white racist freedom of whites, right? It's staggering, right? 80%. And you want to go make sure that you find a way to continue to criminalize Black people as a whole.
Absolutely. And they'll always want to pivot to some kind of foreign threat, Al-Qaeda, ISIS, Al-Shabaab. They'll pivot to that when, in fact, they know what the threat is. Now what we're seeing is that Jews and progressive politicians are actually also being blamed for helping facilitate this looming demographic change. I follow many of these white supremacist, white nationalist sites, obviously, because that's what I do. There was a time when I went to their home pages and they had a clock ticking down to the year 2045 as to how much time they had left to do something before the nation changed. They're motivated.
Yeah. So data has been data and data gathering is not only important to your work in general, in the bit of reading I've done on these questions around, you know, mapping police violence, there's very little in the way of a national database, right, to collect this information. Can you give us an update? Because it does seem that, I mean, data doesn't answer everything, but it seems to be an important piece of the puzzle. It would certainly be important for activists who want racial justice to be able to look at the actual numbers of what's going on in terms of police killings, you know, and vice versa.
Well, perfect point, and thank you. In the words of the famous data scientist W. Edwards Deming, without data, you're just another person with an opinion. And so we rely on that. There's a site that your viewers may want to go to that was just launched last week, prosecutekillercops.org, which identifies officers in LA County who have killed people and are still working. And in many times, those numbers are not reflected because someone may get shot and not die the same day. We are working at my center on a national registry, which is also being advanced by a number of community groups, by, interestingly enough, law enforcement, unions, and on both sides of the aisle in the House and the Senate, most notably by, and I have to give her a shout out because our school sits in her district, Congressmember Karen Bass, when they passed the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act last month. And so we're looking at a registry that's going to, in this slice of the data pie, we're going to capture those officers who get fired or resigned due to misconduct so they can't go to another department. There's a really interesting story of an officer who's 31 years old in New Jersey. He is on his 9th department. And the only reason you don't know about him is because he hasn't killed anybody yet. Why is that? So what we're going to focus on doing is getting those officers who have been fired due to things like excessive use of force, corruption, domestic violence, sexual assault, harassment, falsifying police reports, planting evidence. We want to get them out of the profession. And that's one of the things we're working on doing. We are proposing to call the Lewis Registry after Congressman John Lewis. The acronym for Lewis is going to stand for Law Enforcement Work Inquiry System. And we're going to try to get that stood up. So we will have at least that slice of those officers who have been problems, been fired. And I've already mentioned how difficult that is to do, that they stay out of the profession. So data is very important. But what's interesting is if you look at data, it doesn't show you the real picture. One of the things the site that I gave you is going to show you is that you'll see half as many of those officers identified in most databases. The reason it's twice the number is because this group went the next step and identified officers that are still working, which now is twice as many. So data is critical, and we are relying on that.
USC is blessed to have you, and we are blessed to have you because your voice, your analysis, your vision, and your witness is one that really has made a difference, though, brother.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
To make a difference, though.
Yeah.
No, that's very important, though, man. Yes. I can get a sense in which brothers and sisters like you of all colors, but especially the chocolate, that kind of appreciation of what it's like to be on the inside. Those of us on the outside, you know, we could throw words and rocks in our bodies, and go to jail and so forth. And there's a role for that. But you also have to have folk on the inside, like your father said, you know, that are trying to create spaces because you're dealing with a chronic sickness here.
Yeah,
I agree. If I could just offer one more thing in that regard. I went in the FBI in 1984. There are fewer African-American agents today than there were in 1984.
Wow. Yeah, back and forth, back and forth. Let me ask you one question before we let you go, because our tightrope time is running low. If you could tell young activists today that there would be one aspect where they could really make a wedge in terms of police behavior and change policy, not by joining the police or by, I don't mean them, but just as from an activist perspective or even from a perspective, what should we be focusing on? Where are one of the most important places to intervene to maybe unlock some of this or dissipate some of this sickness, as we just called it?
I think they're doing it. Accountability. Mm-hmm. Start talking to the mayor. Start talking to the council. Mm-hmm. What's the money being spent on? Are there any metrics that are being looked at with regards to how successful they are? Mm-hmm. And as you mentioned previously, in talking to those officials and holding them accountable, civilian oversight. If there's a civilian oversight board, they should be part of it. Those police departments are policing their neighborhoods. The neighborhood needs to talk about how it should be done. And I think they're doing what you, in the way of your question, it's happening now. They're demanding accountability, and accountability, with all due respect, starts with the money.
Yeah.
And I think they should be engaged.
Yeah. That's actually a pretty hopeful place to end. I don't know if you have any final comments, Errol or Cornell, before we head on out.
Well, the only thing I want to do is thank you both for all the work that you do. I'm a huge admirer of both of you. I appreciate the opportunity to here to contribute. But again, I'm just going to say that it's been an honor and a privilege to do the things I've done through my career. Again, thank God to mom and dad who and the things that they did for me. And I'm just going to try and leave the world a little better place and hopefully some folks in my place that can continue the fight, because the struggle will always be here and always continue.
Yeah, that's so true. I mean, the struggle is perennial, isn't it? It's endless.
It sure is.
Just hold on to your integrity, honesty, decency, your courage, your willingness to serve others, especially the least of these. Keep a smile on your face and keep some style in how you move through space and time. Not just because you're an alpha man, but because.
Well, you all have a lot of style, and so we're going to be all right.
Thank you.
Well, it was such a pleasure to have you with us, Errol, and you are welcome back anytime on the tightrope, and keep fighting the good fight, and thank you for your integrity and for your willingness to be an open interlocutor. This is a tough set of issues. A lot of people are very hurt and enraged and don't see any possibility, and I think you've actually opened some doors there to ways of participating that might do some good. So we're really grateful for that.
Thank you. Thank you. Again, it's been a privilege to contribute today.
Thank you very much. Great to see you.
Thank you, though, brother. We thank you.
All right, Cornell, it's that time again. It is time for office hours, and we are open to do office hours business. And we have a very special topic today. But before we get into the topic, I just want to remind our listeners that this is the weekly segment where we do a deep dive into one of the many intractable issues, and we try to toss the issues around, unpack a little bit here and there, see what we can come up with, or try to answer the unanswerable. And in many ways, this week's question is one of those questions. And it draws from a terrific interview piece in the Washington Post that our dear co-host, Dr. Cornell West, shared. Incredible range of answers to very complicated questions in a succinct and clarifying way. One of the most powerful questions asked, I'm hoping we can drill down a little bit and get him to talk a little bit more about. And that question is this. Is America even capable of treating the masses of Black people with decency and dignity? I want to do a little close read to this phrase that he used, because he didn't just say treating a couple of celebrities who were Black. He didn't say treating the Black people who live right next door to you. He didn't say treating the Black people who you look up to or who is your boss because somebody hired him or her above you. But it's the masses of Black people. That is to say, the unnamed, those who work in groups and who live in groups, who are not one-offs integrating your neighborhood with your permission, but in fact, in some sense, invisible as individuals because of the way we understand race. Can that group of people, can these masses of Black people be treated? Is America even capable of treating this group of people with decency and dignity? Cornell, give us a little bit more about your thoughts about that. I just think it's a profound question.
I think it's a crucial skeleton that hangs in the closet of anybody concerned about Black people or poor people. Marcus Garvey used to stand on the corner of 125th Street and 7th Avenue. He would say, as long as Black people live in America, the masses of Black people will live lives of ruin and disaster. That they will make place for certain exceptional Black people, exceptional Negroes, he would say. But in terms of their cousins, in terms of Jamal, in terms of Shaniqua, in terms of the folk on the block, around the corner, that they will still be dishonored, they will still be devalued, their bodies will be associated with criminality, and their quest for decency will be pushed to the margins. Now, you see, when you look at the historical data, there's a sense in which Garvey's challenge has not been adequately responded to. Because given all the magnificent, unprecedented progress that we've experienced, especially as middle class expansion have taken place, that when it comes to the masses of Black folk in the hoods, in prison and so forth, that their lives still in so many ways echo what Garvey was talking about, ruin and disaster.
Right.
So the question becomes then, well, what do we do? And this goes back to our point we made before about Henry Allen Garnett saying that for Black people, pharaohs on both sides of the bloody Red Sea. So what do you do everywhere you look up and you run into a different pharaoh? Mm-hmm. Well, at that point, you just say to yourself, I refuse to be a spectator. I'm going to be a participant. And therefore, I'm going to learn how to love, fight, laugh more adequately, effectively, to pass on a tradition to a younger generation, but knowing that no matter what I do, I'm still got so much more work to do if the world's going to be a decent place. So the question becomes, well, how do you just leave the world just a little better than you found it, rather than become overwhelmed by despair because the world is full of so much evil, is full of so much undeserved harm and so on.
Right.
So that question is a crucial one, but it's got to be tied to our fight. It's got to be tied to our tenacity. It's got to be tied to our determination, even as we tell the truth about the limits of ourselves. And most importantly, the limits of any society. Every society, empire, social experiment has structural limits and spiritual thresholds.
Yeah.
Just like in our own lives. We can only take so much.
Honey, you don't know. Ain't that the truth?
It only takes so much and we snap. Well, that's true for societies. Well, in the case of America, the white supremacy has been so fundamental in the way in which it's proceeded. Once you really begin to call that into question, you begin to see just how sick your fellow citizens are. Not all of them, but enough of them to get you highly discouraged. So the question becomes, well, how do you become encouraged rather than discouraged in light of recognizing sooner or later, America's going to reach its limits.
Yeah.
It reached the limits in the 1860s with the Civil War. Things went barbaric.
Mm-hmm.
It reached its limits in some ways in the 1960s, but things went barbaric. We just didn't accent it in terms of mass incarceration and vicious treatment of political prisoners and so forth and so on.
Yeah.
So that it's a tough one. But how do you wrestle with that query?
Well, I guess, you know, my short answer would be no, not at this point. But at the same time, I guess I would try to make some daylight between the notion of America as a nation state, right? Which I would say as a nation state may not be capable of treating the masses of Black people with dignity. Draw a distinction and some daylight between the nation state and Americans, right? Or citizens or people who inhabit this space. And to say that there's potential for transforming what it means to treat Black people with dignity and decency if we can cultivate and somehow separate whiteness from the national consciousness. Now, here's where I'm going to find a way to find some daylight, Cornell. It might just be a tiny little sliver, but let me see if I can give you a little bit of extra hope. So I'm thinking, you know, if we take this white supremacist fear of 2040 and the countdown to a dominant non-white nation, some people assume that that demographic shift will, by definition, change and reduce the power of the hierarchy of whiteness. I do not believe that's an automatic matter. We have South Africa, obviously. You can have a majority non-white country that's fully saturated with white supremacist ideology. But we do have the potential here with such a transformation of immigrant populations from around the world to help disconnect their Americanization from their pro-white potential mindset. That is to say, as immigrants become American, they become aligned with what they see as often, not always, right, obviously, but they often become aligned with the dominant ideology of whiteness as a way of being truly American. And I'm wondering if we as Black people can do some work in that moment, right, to treat immigrant communities as a future investment in ending white supremacy, if we work to develop those solidarities and alliances with those constituencies. Now, that's not an excessively hopeful idea, but I think if we're going to have a multiracial world where everyone is relatively proportionate, right, or that there's small numbers of lots of different kinds of people, that opens the door for a new kind of meshing, right? What connects us? What is the language and politics and ideology and expectations that actually tether us to one another? So we can build, it seems to me, some different networks. It's a sliver, bruh. It's a sliver.
We all are desperate. We all grabbing for whatever we can grab it. I'll grab that one with you too, because I think what you're talking about is important. But you know, for me, the other side of this thing is that even these sick white brothers and sisters, so many of them are suffering. They don't have medical care. They don't have jobs with a living wage. Right. They don't have decent housing.
No.
You see, if somehow we could satisfy those basic needs so that whatever people perceived about Black people, it could not translate into Black folk not having access to health care, quality education, job with a living wage, and decent housing, then I do think we'd have a different situation, different phenomena. We're not going to eliminate the hatred, but it would have less translation power because we'd have folk who had some material needs satisfied and some of their material needs satisfied, so that the issue of class here and economic justice here becomes so crucial, but it's not in any way a salvation to get us through the white supremacy, but at least it's a crucial step forward in that regard. I'm just grabbing for straws.
I see your sliver of hope over there too, bruh. No, I agree.
That little sliver,
That's all. We're just messing with tiny light slivers. But I just want to ask one more thing, though, about that class argument, because I agree there's no question that the safety nets for working class, middle class, poor whites have been frayed and destroyed, largely by policies that were ended because of integration and access to those policies by non-whites. That was the justification for ending so many of them or reducing them. But how much of that safety net do you think whites who are prone to white supremacist extremism, not all whites, just this group, I mean, do you think that they, if their economic needs got met, that they'd be happy if at the same time other people of color also had opportunities? I mean, isn't there something about, I want a safety net for me and this should be my privilege, not just a requirement because I'm a human being and I should have basic care, which is what I hear you saying, but that I deserve greater privileges because I'm white? And how do we separate those two things out?
They historically are tied together. They are part of the cultural DNA of the making of a white supremacist civilization like the United States. I think it probably will always be there to some degree. I think white supremacy is going to be around for a long, 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 long time. But we can attenuate the worst of it in terms of the injurious harm that could flow in terms of depriving peoples of color with these basic rights to health care and job and house and so forth. Mm-hmm. They might not want to live next to you. That's fine. They might not like the way you look. That's fine. They don't want to get close to your son or daughter. We understand. But they don't have the power to translate it into such a way that our schools are worse than theirs. They would like for their schools to be worse than theirs. But if you got enough institutional clout. Mm-hmm. But the problem is that in order to reach that kind of policy, you're going to have multiracial coalitions. And if those racial coalitions are weak because of white supremacy, and they associate dealing with poverty with dealing with Black people, then the racism makes it difficult to ever deal with their own poverty, too. And
exactly.
That's the catch-22 that we've seen over and over again in this society.
Right.
And that's
right.
The definition of insanity, as well as a certain spiritual sickness. Just as educators, we try to raise that issue, but we see it among the fellow educators. I mean, it's not like education in and of itself is going to be some major force.
Panacea.
Exactly. Yeah, who's going to educate the educators? You know what I mean? How do you educate the educator? The educator and go on and on and on. Oh. It's only the examples of great courage and love and justice that can seize the imagination of people. And that's in the end why I think the arts are important. I always remind folk that anytime you come down on America, you should really begin with American music. Because American music has probably been one of the most humanizing forces in a sick society.
Yeah.
And I don't mind being profoundly patriotic about Aretha Franklin.
Yeah.
I don't mind being patriotic about James Cleveland and Luther Vandross and James Brown. You say, oh, George Clinton, Bootsy Collins. I'm profoundly patriotic because they are as American as cherry pie. Mm-hmm. And yet they're international in terms of the love that they produce that flows from their souls to every corner of the globe. But that's different than what most people associate patriotism to be.
Right.
And that's why your distinction about the nation state at its worst on the one hand, American citizens at their best are two very, very different things. And very few people make that kind of distinction that you make all the time you made today.
Yeah, no, thanks. You're so right about American music. And to that glorious list, I would also add the ways in which musicians communicate when they're serious about their musicianship, you know, across race in ways that completely ignore the kinds of categorizations and hierarchies that have been established. So you have like the Muscle Shoals music context where, you know, whites are crossing the color line to work with Black musicians in a context that's life-threatening activity, frankly. And you see this throughout U.S. history in many different ways. It's not only Black American musicians in the sense of a kind of global gift. It's also the way the communication and the freedom and the appreciation that musicians have for one another across these so-called boundaries that I think is also hopeful. What they're able to see, what they're able to appreciate, what they know about their differences and their similarities make a huge difference.
True. I got a wonderful note from Brother Wynton Marcellus just the other day. I haven't seen Brother Wynton in a while, but I always salute his genius and things. He and I, we struggle over various issues, but the message that he has about how the music gets at the depths of what it means to be human and therefore has some kind of spiritual and artistic power.
Right, and healing.
That needs to be. And healing, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Healing.
Yeah, there's a way in which it can, it does not always, I would say, it can get below these categories.
That's
it sort of digs below the boundaries that we've erected. It's like there's a wall and music just keeps digging until it gets to the bottom of the wall, comes out the other side. No, it's very true. We should try to talk to Wynton about that
We're going to bring Wynton on.
Yeah, that would be lovely. That would be a gift.
Artists,
yeah.
We still talking about Erykah Badu, the one.
I certainly hope so. I'm talking about her. I'm talking about her all the time. Yeah, Baduism is going to help us through a lot. And it's that freedom that that freedom they have of mind where you're just like, why am I in this box? I don't need to be in this box. I can be in Baduism. I don't need to mess around with this.
I can be in Baduism. That's why I can get on the mothership with George Clinton.
You get on the mothership. You definitely. So there's a lot of places to go. So thank you for this question, though, because to some it might seem provocative, but I think it's an important one to ask about the masses of Black people. What are we capable of doing and seeing and connecting? So and I hope people digest and try to reflect on that critical question. So we are at the end of our office hours right at this point. We're really happy to have you all with us and join us on the tightrope. And our producers, just to remind you, are always looking waiting for your comments and queries. So continue to engage with us on all the platforms, and you just might have your question answered or brought to office hours. So thanks very much. Thanks, Dr. West, for being a great co-host and co-conspirator. And we are thrilled to have had you all on the tightrope. We'll see you again next time.
Thank you for listening to the Tightrope Podcast. If you liked what you heard, please give us a 5-star review and subscribe to the show wherever you listen to your podcast and share it with everyone you know. Please email all questions, suggestions, and compliments to 411@speakerbox.com. That's the numbers 411@speakerbox.com. The Tightrope Podcast is produced by Speakerbox Media in collaboration with the Podcast Laundry Production Company and is executive produced by Dr. Cornell West, Professor Tricia Rose, and Jeremy Berry.